Welcome to Circle A Radio. Tonight we have a very special program. We will be listening to firsthand accounts from people who have been hit by automobiles while riding their bikes. What we will be hearing this evening is a sneak preview of a project that Aaron Yankee and Don Godwin have been working on throughout the past year. This project began and has come to fruition out of a need to raise awareness about bikes and as a response to personal and secondhand experiences with accidents. The 9 Portland and New Orleans bicycle riders that we will hear from have all been seriously injured within the past few years, and are all friends or acquaintances of Aaron and Don. Without citing dehumanizing statistics, we see this as a testament to the everyday risks that bike riders face. We are happy to be able to share this collection of stories on Circle A Radio because we think that it is very important to let people hear firsthand experiences from an increasing population of bicyclists who have survived collisions with cars.
The stories that we will hear are intense. They are candid, they are graphic, and they are very powerful. We are allowed to witness the complex emotions that accompany life-transforming events, such as accidents. Pain, anger, and frustration are entwined with relief and hope. Up first, we will hear a little bit from Don about why he began this project.
Definitely tired of the polarization of people, bicyclists versus car drivers. As far as why I'm doing this in the first place, I'm a survivor of being struck by a car. My accident was my fault, largely, and it was the fault of the automobile driver as well. It was a complicated thing. But a lot of the other people are brain damaged or dead or whatever because of the fault of another person. I just needed to let us speak for ourselves and let those voices reach the shadows that they don't ever reach before. And one of those shadows is inside the car, inside the cars of the greater American society. When you hear a radio broadcast on a mainstream station on a morning commuting talk show that millions of people are listening to in big cities like Atlanta and San Jose and where else, it's like, yeah, as a bicyclist, I have to balance that out and tell the story of a bicycle commuter and a group of bicycle commuters that have a commute every day and have to go to work and have to do it on their bicycles and enjoy doing it on their bicycles. And there's really no reason that it shouldn't work harmoniously with the car community and the bike community. There's no reason they shouldn't be all the same community in a certain way and respect and understand each other. But as the interviews show, it doesn't work out that way.
The day was beautiful. It hadn't been raining, but it had that moist February kind of morning feeling about it, and everything was like very, very blue and slightly overcast. And I was kind of invigorated by my bike ride downtown. And
it was really cold and windy that morning, and my ears aren't covered. I've always really been weird about that because it removes me too much from this world of just being in my body on a bicycle and moving. Like, I love that. I was just riding along, and like, next thing I knew, this bus was right next to me, and it was really scary because my arm was right up against the bus. I just was thinking, like, watching this gigantic wheel go past me. All right, as long as your head doesn't go under the wheel, you're fine.
We got cold, and we started to ride down the hill, and we were struck.
When I was standing over my bike, just waiting, a bus passed by right in front of us, and I was about 4 or 5 feet forward of where the minivan was, so I was pretty sure that they saw me standing there beside them, And I turned to watch the bus pass me, and I just felt this nudge, like the minivan hit me in the back.
I'm halfway into the intersection, like my front tire is like halfway in the middle of the intersection when I see this car coming. And the car is driving all erratic, and then it slows down, but then I realize that he's not going to stop. And so I pedaled really hard, and I remember going, oh, like really loud, because I knew he was going to hit me. The moment where you know someone's going to hit you is just so terrible. He hit my back tire, and I just went flying. And I came down and landed on my left hand really hard.
This big moving truck stopped for me at the crosswalk. And the guy in the front seat was waving his hands like, go, 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 go. Which I just thought that meant go, 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 go. The street is clear. Don't worry about it. So I went, and right when, I just remember so clearly, like just when I passed the front of the massive tall grill, looking to my left and just seeing this car so close, going so fast, and knowing that I was totally done. Just having that split second thought of, oh fuck, I just made the worst mistake of my life. And it totally hit me.
The bus was pulling ahead of me, and I'm like, all right, sweet. And then I pedal, and as that foot went down, the world went black, and I fell over.
The driver, going 70 miles an hour, 2.5 times over the limit of drinking, saw Larry, I guess, and Larry was riding in the rear, and then Angela was riding, and then me and Orion were riding like side by side. We were actually racing down the hill. I remember that. And he swerved and missed Larry and then hit Angela and then hit me and Orion.
She pulled out and I swore she saw me, but she didn't. And I went under the car. She just crept forward. She's going so slow, and I was really surprised how hard she hit me, kind of, for how slow she was going.
And I remember very distinctly the feeling of the front wheel going over my hips. I just remember the crushing sensation of having, like, and the sound of the wheel hitting the pavement, like, right in front of me. And I remember closing my eyes and not knowing if the back wheel was gonna come over my head.
I smashed his windshield out completely. His windshield was totally in as many little pieces as you can imagine. And he kept the car parked about 100 yards away.
I remember that I got hit, but I didn't see anything. And then I don't know what happened. I remember opening my eyes and I was sitting on the ground or laying on the ground. There was a car parked in front of me, like it had pulled around me and stopped. There was a lady getting out of the car.
Got about 15 feet away, they punched the gas and came straight at me and rammed me head on and knocked me down. I was pretty much knocked senseless by hitting the ground, and they slowly got out of the car and said, "Where's the money?" Of course, I had none. The feeling I had at the time was pretty much like I had 1 or 2 minutes to live. I was lamenting, working my ass off for what? They realized that I had no money, and they sheepishly got back in their car and drove away slowly. It had broken my left knee, and I had never experienced any sort of pain like that, and I was completely out of it.
She just kept going. I don't think she realized she hit me. Her window was down, but she was very, very old, maybe 90, way too old to be driving, or just not sharp enough to be driving. She hit me, and I went under the front of the car about halfway, kind of in front of my bike. I was thrown a little bit forward. And then she just kept going for about 15 feet halfway across the intersection into the lane she wanted to turn into. And then people were on the sidewalk waving their arms and yelling for her to stop, and she heard it through her window. and luckily she did. And all the while I was screaming like a little infant. Just screaming, blah. Not even words, just noises. And so my bike was about underneath the front axle, and I was underneath the radiator. But I could still see up as I was moving forward on the street. It seemed like everything went silent. It was almost like I was underwater. It seemed like it took a long time, but I'm sure it was just a split second. I looked over and I could see the pedestrians looking at me, then looking at the woman, then looking back at me, and realizing that she didn't know she even hit me.
Angela flew off her bike, and then Orion hit the back of a Bronco and shattered the glass and then fell. And then I don't know how far I flew, but I landed. And
I remember being struck. I remember feeling like wedged in between the car and between the bicycle. And I remember like falling down onto the ground and being dragged.
The pain was like nothing I've ever felt before, so I knew it had to be broken.
Instantly, I started screaming at the top of my lungs and crying. It was a good thing because the person didn't even know what they'd hit. They didn't know it was a person. They didn't know anything.
I remember being on the hood of the car. And I remember kind of laying on my back and looking at the sky and thinking, where am I right now? This is such a weird feeling. And then he hit his brakes, which made me just kind of roll very quickly off the front of the car onto the ground. My first thought was, holy ish, I can just stand up. I'm totally alive. Whoa, that was massive. So I tried to stand up and realizing at that moment that there was a problem.
Later witnesses said it looked like I was a bag of laundry just tumbling. That happened for like 50 feet.
But when she finally did stop, I picked up my bike and kind of carried it over because it wouldn't roll anymore to her window. And she was white as a sheet and kind of greenish looking. And looked like she was about to have a heart attack. I reached in and just kind of comforted her. I patted her on the arm and was like, I don't think I said don't die on me, but that's what I was thinking. She seemed so shook up, like she might not even be able to drive away.
God damn it. This sucks so bad. I can't even believe it. Guy got out of his car and was all like drunk and telling me that he didn't really hurt me and that he would give me a ride home with my bike, basically trying to say that I wasn't hurt.
Help, no.
And he was just, I mean, he was like screaming, you know. He was running over to each of us and, you know, he sort of saw like, I think he knew right away what had happened, you know, that like Angela was dead and Orion was dead, and then he ran over to me and I guess I was saying something like, ow, ow.
I don't think I was crying. I think I was just really in shock. I couldn't move very well. And my bike was a few feet behind me. I couldn't move my foot. My head and shoulders hurt. I ended up pulling all the muscles from like my neck down to my chest. So this lady and her daughter helped me in her car, and I grabbed my shoe. I have a road rash on the outside of my left ankle and all the way up my left leg. I had tire marks on the back of my leg, on the back of my left leg. Oh, and then I had road rash all up the right side of my back. And my right collarbone is broken, and my head was split open just to the right side, the top of my head.
Several cars drove by slowly looking at me and then driving away. I'm assuming that they assumed that I was drunk and just unable to get on my bike.
The bus driver stopped and he's like, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm okay. And then somebody tried to help me stand up. I was like, no, because like my arm was twisted behind my back on the way that the concrete was like supporting it or something. I'm not exactly certain what happened, but when they tried to pick me up, I was like, no, it's not okay. And they called an ambulance, and I'm just like, oh no, this is too much.
And I remember the colors the best, the colors of like, of the asphalt, the colors of the gray and the blue. And the only thing that wasn't in this field of gray and blue was my blood, which was just rushing out of my nose.
And I remember kind of getting up, and I remember everybody on the street looking at me like, oh my God, she just got up. At that moment, I was kind of like the walking dead, you know, like people were pretty shocked.
After we got hit, the driver kept driving, and he had Orion and Angela's bikes actually lodged underneath the van. The cop heard, obviously, the car skidding and the metal and everything, and so he stopped the driver right away. And then the cops immediately called the ambulance. So the ambulance was probably there in like 5 minutes.
I remember my neighbors being there because they had heard the accident from 3 or 4 blocks up. Just being like, don't worry, baby, we got your bike, we're gonna take your bike home, don't worry. And then a TV camera coming up and trying to film me and being really mad and cursing at the TV camera.
I remember I was twisted on the ground. I was laying over on my right side, and I remember the colors of everything, that everything was super quiet, that I couldn't move without tremendous amounts of pain, that I barely had enough strength to hold my upper body up. I couldn't lay down because my femur was dislocated into my pelvis. I was beginning to feel like I was gonna pass out, and I never did, but I felt totally nauseous and dizzy.
There were these gouges in the pavement from my bike being stuck underneath the front of the car because it was one of those smaller roundos that ride very low to the street.
The lady who hit me, she never came by. She parked her car down the street, and she had called her lawyer straight away and stayed as far away from me as possible, and she's never tried to contact me since. For all I know, the only difference in her life is that her insurance went up a bit.
But I also remember apologizing to him as much as I could from the distance that I was at, because I knew that I scared the shit out of him. I knew it was sort of my fault because I had trusted this other driver, but I also knew that he was one of the 400,000 people in this city who don't know what a fucking crosswalk is and understand that if one car is parked in front of a crosswalk, that probably means that you should also stop, you know?
Right after I was struck, this very nice yuppie couple came back from processing their breakup at a Starbucks and saw me lying on the ground, and this guy rushed over to me and was like, oh my God, and he prevented the construction workers from moving me, and he went and got my glasses from across the street. And he just stood there and put his hand on my hand and said, we're gonna get you help, and he was very reassuring.
Paramedics were there, and they put me on one of those stiff board, like when they think you have a spinal injury. They put me on that thing and basically like saran wrapped my head and my feet down so that I couldn't move at all, even if I wanted to.
It was like in one of those movies when you're like laying on the gurney and the lights are flashing above you and they're going roof, 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 roof. Like that, and they're just like wheeling me really fast.
This lady's like, well, I don't think I hit you. It's the lady. I couldn't have hit you. It must have been the person in front of me. She said, oh, well, let me give you my number. So she wrote down 2 numbers on a piece of paper. And then I looked, and she had only given me 6 digits of one of the numbers.
The hospital was pretty rough, I have to say. I mean, and I think I had the best go of it possible. The hardest thing about being hurt to the point where your life is threatened is that you get to see the fear in the eyes of the people who love you. When people started coming in when I was in the ICU, it was so frustrating. I just wanted to talk. I just wanted to be like, holy ish, can you believe this happened? I can't believe it, and laugh and joke and be like, God, I'm so glad I'm alive. I wrote letters into the palms of my friend's hands. And I don't remember this part so much, but my friend Marisa said that I scrawled in her hand, I'm mad. She felt like I was going to be okay. And there's a lot of feeling like I need to say, I'm okay, I'm okay.
When they finally got around to me, they told me that my wrist was broken to the point where I was probably going to have surgery, but they were just going to set it and wait 2 weeks and put it in like this temporary splint cast thing. So they came out and set it. That was the most awful part, I think. First, they injected my wrist full of lanacane twice, and that stuff hurts. And then they put my fingers in like these weird mesh grabber things. And then the orthopedic surgeon's assistant put this band around my elbow and put his foot in the other part and pulled. It was like pulling my arm away from my hand, and then the orthopedic surgeon pushed my bones back into where they were supposed to go. And I've never ever experienced anything so excruciating and seemed really, really barbaric. It hurt so much more than when I broke it.
I remember seeing the waiting room on the side, and then she went in. I remember being wheeled in, and then I remember seeing her on the left talking to the nurse, maybe to registration or something like that. She said, oh, I'm going to get out and get paper towels to clean her car. And then that's the last time I saw her. And then they put me in the emergency room. And for a long time, I was just like, oh, it kind of hurts, I guess. You know, like everything hurts a little bit. I was more scared. I hate the hospital. I hate hospital bills. I was really afraid of that. And then I found out, like, my ankle was broken. They gave me x-rays. My ankle was broken. I couldn't sit up by myself. They had to, like, put their arms underneath me and lift me up to get my shoulder x-rayed. And like, they told me my collarbone was broken, which I just thought was a discomfort with a neck brace. And told me I needed stitches in my head or staples in my head.
My mom, you know, flew from New Mexico and got there. That was probably, like, a day later, like, after all the surgeries, and I woke up and everything. And I saw her, and I tried to open my mouth to talk to her, but I couldn't talk because they had done the surgery through my side, and so they had to deflate my lung. And so when they did that, I had this crazy breathing tube, and so I had all these tubes in my nose and my mouth and my throat. I remember sort of knowing what had happened, but not really knowing. You know, just like knowing that obviously something really fucked up had happened to me, but I was so in and out that like I hadn't put all the pieces together. And then when I woke up the second or third time, Larry's mom was there. She's just like this really spiritual being. And she comes to me, and this is when I have the breathing tubes out and I can talk again, but I'm like really weak. And she's like, honey. And I'm like, Rhonda. And I like, it was like the first time I really sort of remember having this like connection with someone. She just had these words for me, and I don't know what they were, but I sort of knew that I was going to be okay. She kind of told that to me. She was like, it's going to be okay. The next time I could really talk to my mom, I said, are Orion and Angela okay? And my mom just looked at me and started crying, and she just shook her head, and I just knew that they were gone. I didn't even ask about Larry, so I must have somehow known that Larry was okay. At that point, I was really tripped out because I was like, wow, I'm really fucked up, but my friends are dead. It was too much to, like, know that and sort of be where I was.
I was so scared. At first, the intern thought that my elbow was just dislocated. And they did a reduction on it, which is, like, a bunch of people hold you and a bunch of people pull on your arms. This, like, weird pull twist, and it sort of springs back in a socket.
They moved me after like 3 days, I think, to like sort of a regular hospital room. And then at that point, I was able to have more visitors and I was more stabilized. And the visitor part was really weird because I felt like I knew that everyone meant well. Everyone was coming to see you to just basically be like, I'm so glad you're alive. And like, you don't even have the energy to like reciprocate anything. You're just like, yeah, I'm alive, but look at the condition I'm in and look what happened. And I guess I'm supposed to be thankful, but really, I'm just really up in the head, you know?
And when that was all going on, at one point I heard this thunk inside my cask, and I was like, oh, that's really weird, but nobody else seemed to hear it. I didn't say anything about it, and then they put me back in the room, and I was like, yeah. And they came in, and they were like, yeah, well, your elbow redislocated when we were doing that. And then I was like, oh, that was that thunk I heard. Next time I hear it, I'll let you know. You know, like, I was so out of it. And they're like, and the tip of your radius is broken off, and we're going to have to do surgery to reattach it with pins and stuff. And then I just broke out sobbing. I was like, ah, you know, because they knew my real name and they knew everything about me. They had me, I don't know how much that stuff cost, but I was just like, I'm going to be in debt for the rest of my life. And they're like, no, it's charity. If you can't pay, it'll be worked out. Because at one point I was ready to refuse the surgery. I was like, just let me go. Like, it'll figure itself out.
Yeah, going to the hospital and waiting and getting all fixed up and having that one of my first real, true New Orleans experiences, also being in, like, the free hospital. But also realizing how privileged I was being the only white girl in there and how much attention I was getting from all the white young doctors from Tulane and how everybody remembered my name. And throughout the whole process of getting surgery and getting casts and no casts and casts and no casts and all of these things, that like no matter where I went, everybody remembered who I was and remembered my name and my problem and everything, and knowing that most of the other people that went there didn't have that experience at all, which is pretty crazy.
I was hospitalized for a month overall, which is, I think, a short amount of time. If I had private insurance, they would have definitely kept me in there. On the other hand, I was young. I am young and healthy beforehand, and I had no other health issues. But when I got home and was faced with myself in a wheelchair in a cold house and learning how to maneuver and manage in a neck brace, it felt like I was out too soon, that I was just too delicate and needed too much care. I couldn't bend over. I couldn't do anything. I mean, my injuries were so thorough and so severe. The list goes like this. My right femur was dislocated into my pelvis, so I had an acetabulum fracture. My sacrum, which is that weird bone underneath your spine, that was cracked. My left ischium, like your sitting bones, they were cracked. And there's some other bone in my pelvis that was cracked. My ribs were cracked. I was bleeding into my lungs from my heart. There's some sort of abrasion to my heart that happened that made it so that I had a big collection of blood in my lungs. And that is also a really lucky thing, was that I screamed before I was run over. Had I not screamed, there's a really good chance that my lung would have been punctured by one of my ribs. In which case, that's really super dangerous. My neck was broken on a couple vertebrae. I had fractures in like C4, 5, 6, and 7. My nose was broken, and my right orbital lobe, which is the bone behind your eye, my right eye was cracked. So I had head injuries, neck injuries, and pelvic injuries.
You're listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. We'll continue with more of the bicyclists' stories in a moment.
person who hit me was a tranny named Stephanie Greathouse, and they were very sympathetic, and they were saying, like, oh my god, I'm such a big sissy, and I'm so sorry, and I'm such a softy, and they kind of rubbed my leg down and wouldn't let me move, and immediately called the authorities. At first, it seemed really nice that they were so accommodating and sweet to me, and they said they would bring me anything I wanted and we would be best friends forever. And then it turned into, oh, please don't file an insurance claim. Oh, please, please, I'll just do anything, but if you file an insurance claim, you're going to screw me. Stephanie would call me like 4 or 5 times a day for the first couple of days and just say, I know that money sounds really good to you, girl, but just think about me. You're just going to screw me. If you file a claim, you just might as well kill me. But at the same time, the conversation would flip-flop into like, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm taking responsibility for what I did. And I ended up hiring a lawyer. It meant that I could go to the doctor, and I could actually choose a doctor, and the lawyer, if the doctor would work with the lawyer, then the lawyer would front all the money and I would never have to pay anything, and most likely I would get money back for having to go to the doctor.
Well, they took me in an ambulance to the rehab hospital because I couldn't, like, get in a car yet or anything. It was just so weird because, like, I suddenly, like, was supposed to, like, do physical therapy and, like, wear shoes, and, like, I was just like, I'm flat on my back. And I understood why they wanted me to do these things, but it was like boot camp. They woke me up at 6 in the morning, and they were just like, okay, wheel you down to the 3rd floor, and, like, you're gonna, like, get up and, like, try and use a walker. And, like, the first day I was there, like, there was this mirror, and I had not seen a mirror. I, like, hadn't looked at my face. I hadn't looked at my body. And I watched myself stand up, and when I stood up, I looked thin, like I had probably lost, I don't know, 15 pounds or something like that. My party booty was, like, totally gone. I was, like, in a week, I just felt transformed. I mean, I just looked like this gaunt person. And I got up, and I took, like, 2 steps, and I was, like, I'm done. It was so discouraging and hard.
Yeah, I guess since I acted like I was fine, everybody just assumed that I was totally fine. But it was really hard. I mean, I got up and went to work every day, but it was hard to even, like, get dressed. Because I had a huge cast on my arm. It was so fucking heavy. When you were asking me about work, like, I used my feet a lot. It was kind of pretty amazing, like, how quickly my body could adapt to this change. Say to take a bucket of paint, and I would lift the can up, and to tip it, I would use my right foot and balance on my left foot, and pour the paint into the paint pan. I just used my feet for everything, to take the roller covers off. I was like a circus sideshow act. I mean, but I could only work for about 5 hours a day. But I had to go back to work. I mean, I support myself, so no one else was going to work for me.
I feel like I had a pretty good attitude through most of it, but kind of secretly had a really, really hard time. I didn't handle it very well. Like, once I realized how I couldn't do things I wanted to do, that I just started working at the bike project here a lot, and now I couldn't even get to the bike project. I couldn't tighten bolts because I couldn't use my right arm. All I could do is sit at the bike project and watch while they did things. It's really, really hard, because I feel like I'd finally kind of found things I wanted to do in my life and found a place that I wanted to be. Outwardly, I think that I seemed like I was doing all right. And overall, I was doing really well. Like, I still, as terrible as I felt, or as scared as I was about everything, and as upset as I was, I still got up, and I still went out, and I still hung out with people. And when I left, I kind of just freaked out one night. I couldn't deal with being here anymore, with my roommate being stressed out, and with not having any money, and realizing that it's been a month and a half, and I'm not better.
It's so hard to cook with one hand. Like, it's really, really hard. You can't really chop much of anything. You cannot open a can with a can opener with one hand. It's impossible.
I felt so loved, and I felt, but I also felt so overwhelmed, and I really wanted to be alone, and I really wanted to do things for myself. So along with like feeling really loved and supported, I felt totally smothered and totally dependent.
I ended up leaving town. It took 6 weeks. I had a cast, but I couldn't lift anything over 5 pounds, 10 pounds with my right arm. It threw me off because I was just settling into living here and really liking my job and really liking where I was living and getting to know people, and I couldn't stay.
They liked to tell me that I wasn't going to be able to walk for 8 months to a year. I healed like freakishly rapidly well and had, like I said, was walking a couple months afterwards. Not fast. But I was walking and was able to be on a bicycle. I was really excited to get back on a bike. I felt like it was important. I felt like when you're bound up and you can't go anywhere by yourself, you can barely leave your house, everyone around you is taking care of you. I wanted to be on a bike so I could be alone. So I could go somewhere alone, so I could like decide where I was gonna go.
My partner, who we broke up during the recovery period, which was too bad. Realizing how little he was willing to help me in that situation and how little he did take care of me, which sounds really mean to say in retrospect, but he and my other roommate were just always inviting people to come stay at the house, and the door was always open, and I was, of course, sleeping a lot in bed, and it was just not a good situation.
There are constant reminders of it. There's always pain. There are large scars, but I don't feel like I've been traumatized by it. I just feel like it's become as much a part of my life as anything else that happens to you. It's definitely like in the fabric of who I am. And
yeah.
It's been enough time, and I'm in good enough condition where I definitely don't think of it every day, and I don't think of like, I'm not afraid to ride my bicycle, and I'm not overly cautious. I'm a cautious bike rider now, but I don't feel like I have developed any neurosis around biking or bike safety.
I went to go get a bike pretty much like the day that the doctor told me that I could ride an actual bike. Because I had been riding this stationary bike on my front porch for like 2 months. I'd always pretend like I was winning the Tour de France. Or I was going for donuts. And then I'd always ask everyone what kind of donut they wanted.
It's interesting, like, going through my own near-death trauma and seeing how it's affected me and then watching other people go through stuff. Trauma's a really interesting thing. I think that a lot of what you're left with depends on the resources you had when you went through it. I feel like I just had so much love and support, and I was incredibly physically strong before my accident that my body could withstand it, and like I could afford to lose 30 pounds in muscle and fat.
For a while, I
had the notion that I was going to keep my job, and it was really only one of my arms that was broken, and there's buses, and I probably could have ride one-armed and like, you know, just steered with my other arm. I was having all these notions of being like super tough in my mind. I was just a couple days out of the hospital, and I was in the kitchen at the warehouse, and I made some toast, and then I was trying to butter it. And you know, you don't even think about it, but how you T-square your fingers to like hold the bread in place. The way they had splinted my arm after the surgery was really awkward, like it was at a high angle. It went from my armpit all the way down to almost covering my pinky. And so like I couldn't use that arm at all. Just trying to butter my toast, and it fell on the floor. I picked it up, I'm trying to butter it again, and like I can't seem to keep it on the counter. And this guy who lived there was just watching me like butter my toast to the floor and pick it up and do it again. And then do it again. He's like, hey, I'll butter that for you. And I was like, yeah, you do that, thanks. And I just walked out of the kitchen and into this main open play area space where they have shows and stuff, closed the door behind me, and just screamed.
I just really wish that that bus driver had made a bigger swing around me. He said he swung around me. I wish it was bigger. Like, it was just negligent. It just felt like it could have easily been avoided.
Everything sort of seemed boiled down to the simplest of elements, and it was just like, really what matters is your health and your family and your happiness and your love. And just knowing that we take every little thing for granted. I kept swearing up and down. I was like, if I ever get on a bike again, or if I can ever drive a car again, I will not take it for granted. When I think that I'm having a bad day or I feel bad about something, and I'm like walking down the street and I'm like, well, at least I'm walking. At least I can pee. At least like I can like have sex again and enjoy myself.
You ride your bicycle as like your main mode of transportation, like you understand getting there is going to take longer, you know, and you pay attention to where you're riding and have to be aware of that, but it's also relief of internal pressure. Like it feels so nice for like the air on your skin and to just be like out. You have all these options on a bicycle it doesn't seem like you have in cars. In cars it's like these weird boxy components that take up all the space there is. I started thinking about, like, you know, with bicycles, when you're riding along these narrow streets in between the parked car and the moving car, you can catch the person's eye in the moving car and signal to them, give them a wave or eye contact, or you can, like, point, I'm going to cut in front of you, you know, and you get a little bit ahead and you see them slow down and you see it's okay and you cut around, you can swerve. I started thinking about, like, that's sort of how a lot of people I know operate their lives. Scurrying around the edges, whereas like these like boxes that are stuck and the one in front of it has to move for it to move forward is more like the graduation of life. You know, you're born and you go to school and you get out of school and you get married and you got kids and you make sure those kids go to school and they get married and they have kids, and if you're really lucky you're going to see four generations of that, you know, and it's just like you're this car that's behind this car and then there's this other car and you all have to make certain the one ahead of you moves so you can move. Whereas I feel like my friends and myself are just sort of like scurrying around that. It's never like this prescribed lifestyle that we can't stop in the middle of the road and get out and just quit it. If you're on a bicycle and you're done with it, you're done. You know, you can stop it wherever. Nobody really cares.
Oh, for a while I was wearing this ridiculous orange baseball cap with huge silver wings on it, thinking that if I would wear things that were really bright and outlandish, that this is the attention. The attention drawing system. Fiesta for the eyes.
People tell me that I ride my bike like a grandma, and I'm like, well, I'm just a little more aware. Maybe I am over careful, but I don't want to get hit again. I look people in the eye a lot, drivers specifically, and if I'm riding up alongside someone and I'm between parked cars and a car next to me and I'm riding up, I totally turn and look at them, make sure that they see me. I guess, like, that has changed. My nonverbal communication with people in cars has changed a lot.
It just seemed like for months afterwards, I was so afraid of dying. It felt like every 5 minutes I would have a flash of getting hit by a car, and I would have a flash of, like, getting my face smashed to bits. I really thought I was going a little bit crazy.
Finally. I mean, it's a year and a half, and I feel like myself on my bike again. It's taken that long. And I used to be one of those power bicyclists that would be like, ah, it's August in New Orleans, and I'm riding my bike 7 miles a day. That's just how I got around. I'm back to riding my bike, but it's good because it's forced me to re-evaluate myself and my relationship with my bicycle and my relationship with the streets and everything. I'm glad that I'm back to that, but it has changed. I will gladly take any criticism, calling me a grandma, whatever. It's fine with me, as long as I have all my limbs and I'm not getting creamed by a car. I don't mind it.
It's the tendency of a driver to not look over their right shoulder when pulling over to the right. I caught myself doing the same thing after being pushed by cars from that mistake. And then I caught myself doing the same thing. I went, uh-oh, yes. So I understood the driver a little better, but generally when I suspect a car of doing that, I'll ride up to be equal with the driver so they can see me. Or I'll just be flat out ready for that to happen when there's a car alongside of me.
When I put the whole accident in the context of like a larger problem, you know, it's scary, and I continue to ride my bike, and I ride at night. I try to wear a helmet. Sometimes I forget. Actually, last night I was riding my bike and I wasn't wearing a helmet. Like, it's new to me to wear a helmet. Like, as a kid, I never even wore a helmet. It's also weird because I'm a driver, and so there's that whole aspect. I'm terrified of hitting a biker. There has to just be awareness and consideration, and it's a whole mindset, I think, of like that everything that you do affects other people, and that you just have to always remember that you're not the only one out there.
As much as I was riding my bike down the street and I had no idea I was going to get hit by a car that day, I had no idea. Did this guy know that he was going to have some body fly into his windshield that day? That is so scary. Can you imagine the guilt of thinking that you nearly killed a person with your vehicle? What's amazing is that some people don't feel guilty about that.
I usually don't trust the vehicles. Like, I sort of assume that nobody really sees me at all. So I'm sort of on guard the entire time. I think it's good to ride aggressively sometimes because it makes car drivers, as a general population, a little bit more aware of bicyclists when you ride aggressively. But I think if enough people are on their bikes, being, like, safely belligerent around cars, that it makes car drivers a little more aware of what they are in. It's a big responsibility to be inside of 2 tons of metal. And because they never have to feel a thing, but bicyclists are vehicles and pedestrians. They want you to decide if you're a vehicle or a pedestrian, but I'm saying we're both.
Biking's great. We're at war right now over oil. That's a great statement. Just to become not depend on your gas-filled vehicle. Which is another irony, is that after I never had a car or drove, but that I have one now. I can't always bike. My body hurts too much.
In India, if somebody hit a bike, a crowd would gather and they would pull that driver out of the car and beat them to a pulp. That would happen there. And here, because the mass populace here does not ride bikes, innocent bystanders are not moved by these situations where they should be moved by these situations, moved to get into the situation and make something okay.
I do think it's the responsibility of the state of Louisiana, who is responsible for the Department of Motor Vehicles, to make the drivers go through the proper testing. That requires turn signaling and awareness of bicyclists and pedestrians. I know in Europe, in Germany, for instance, my friend went to get a driver's license. The testing and studying period took several months, and it cost 2,000 Deutschmarks, which was about $1,500. It wasn't no $10 driver's license out of a Cracker Jack box like in America. Now, I'm sure there's people that get killed in Germany driving, but I bet you the percentage is not what it is here. I mean, in America, wasn't it 45,000 people a year die in car crashes? And they're worried about West Nile virus, where one or two people have died. West Nile! But they don't talk about the Swedish fucking drivers killing each other day in, day out. 45,000. Oh, let me get my calculator. 45,000 divided by 365. That's 123 a day. People dying on the national highways here.
I hear when people get in accidents, they have the whole life is short revelation. And mine was kind of the opposite. Time really changed for me in the way that I really felt like life was too long to have a body that felt good in. That life is long enough that if your body doesn't feel if you cannot manage your pain, if you cannot enjoy yourself, you know, whatever, find your meaning in the world. That life is really fucking long, and that it's really that there's not a lot of time to fuck around. Before that, it is hard to commit to things. I wouldn't decide if I wanted to do things. Like, a month seemed like a long time. I couldn't plan anything beforehand, and it's not like I love to plan right now. I just look at time differently. I can say, I can spend 3 years doing this. That's fine. I'm young, and I'm so lucky to have a body that works with a minimum of stress and pain.
The year anniversary point, I knew was going to be hard, and I sort of dreaded it. And then when the actual event happened, it was like, gave me this really positive thing to put all my energy into. The energy was really joyful rather than sad. And I thought I was going to feel this, like, immense pressure to, like, be on the spotlight about it or something, but I wasn't. I just felt the energy was just right, and I was like, oh, we're doing the right thing. Like, we were supposed to, like, celebrate and play music and be together and not have it be, like, this alone, depressed thing. Orion and Angela's spirits were just totally there. There was just sort of, like, this beauty and this calm and this awesomeness about those few days. Yeah, and the bike ride was really cool, riding up to Tabor and stuff. A lot of people came out for the critical mass here, probably 150 or something like that. Probably like 50 or 60 people rode all the way up to Tabor, and it was just this landmark, you know. And then we just rode right down and went and like had the concert, like just rode down and like we filled it. It was really badass is what it was.
Even with the intense fear that I often have about getting hit, I would never give up my bicycle. Never, never, never. It's the best part of my life. It makes everything that I do more fun. Without a doubt, it's worth it to me. Everybody can come up with a million reasons that you shouldn't be doing what you're doing, but how are you ever going to explain to them that that's like one of the most enjoyable things in your life? You'd think it would be apparent. Maybe that's our job. Maybe that's what people aren't getting, is that we're not making it apparent enough that this is the one of the best things in our lives.
This documentary will be titled One Shoe in the Road and will be available by March 2005. Thanks to Don Godwin, Karen, Hope, Kristen, Caroline, Andy, Jeff, Stevie, Shanna, Shelley, Effie, Chainbreaker Zine, Pat, Kate, and all the musicians. For more information about the project, contact Don Godwin at ipcp@juno.com. We'd also like to take this opportunity to put out some information about some local organizations and upcoming events. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance is a nonprofit bicycle advocacy organization that is committed to making bicycles safer, more convenient, and more accessible. Their website is www.btaforbikes.org. That's BTA for, like the number 4, bikes.org. The Community Cycling Center, located at 1700 Northeast Alberta, is another nonprofit bike advocacy organization and repair shop that focuses on empowering youth. Their website, www.communitycyclingcenter.org, includes bike safety resources. North Portland Bike Works at 3951 North Mississippi Avenue near Shaver is a collectively run nonprofit bike shop and learning center. Contact them at 503-287-1098. And City Bikes, who are neighbors to KBU at Southeast 8th and Ankeny, and also have another location at Southeast 19th and Ankeny, is a well-established, collectively-run bike shop that is committed to sustainability. Every last Friday of the month, bike riders in Portland and in cities all over the world ride in critical mass to raise awareness about bikes on the road and to celebrate this fun and efficient alternative to car culture. This month, Portland's new mayor, Tom Potter, has tentatively agreed to ride the mass. So mark your calendars for Friday, January 28th, and meet up in the North Park blocks at 5:30 p.m. But coming up tomorrow is another important event to come out for if you're able. Tomorrow, January 20th, Thousands of people all over the world will protest the inauguration of George W. Bush. Here in Portland, large protests will convene in the North Park blocks at 4 p.m. The Portland Industrial Workers of the World invites you to participate in a permitted labor march to demonstrate working class demands in solidarity. This march will assemble at the IWW Hall at 616 East Burnside and proceed across the Burnside Bridge to meet up with the main protests downtown.
Thanks for listening to Circle A Radio. We are on the first and third Wednesdays of every month from 6 to 7 p.m. Our email address is info@circlearadio.org to send us information, announcements, and feedback. Stay tuned for DJ Audio and Nonstop Hip Hop. Thanks for listening.